Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Galaxy Geekdom podcast. I am one of your hosts, Crystal Williams. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm joined again by our good friend of the show and super guest star for our little mini-series, Anthony Grimuglia. Hi.
Hello there. I have been on this podcast so many times, I request that you give me a host position and a trailer outside in the back of this recording studio that we absolutely really have. I also request...
In our recording studio, you can actually just take one of the larger stalls in the shared bathroom. That'll be your office.
All right. Well, in that bathroom, I request that you have only purple M&Ms, interlaced with an occasional spattering of light pink and deep blue as well. I request you have towels ready for me every day. And most importantly of all, I would like it very much if you never showed me The Exorcist 2 ever again. And we never discussed it, never talked about it, never even mentioned the word John Boorman or Richard Burton in any capacity whatsoever in our lives. And that nobody in the film who'd had no career after this, James Earl Jones, I'm sure he's no one important. I don't want to see him ever again either. It's quite, quite, you know, as you were.
I have some bad news to share for you on the James Earl Jones part.
What?
He is actually famous. I know, shocking.
Shock. Are you saying that he was famous for doing Othello on stage before this movie ever came out? Of course, you're referring to that, obviously.
Yes. Yeah, of course. I wasn't. Oh, wait. He also did this tiny little, like, space schlocky movie called Celestial
Field
Battles,
of Dreams. Field of Dreams.
Field of Dreams. Well, Field of Dreams will make you cry.
Actually, that movie is very good. I can't even continue the joke to make fun of Field of Dreams. That is better.
No, it's a very sweet movie. Better than Star Wars.
Controversial opinion.
Wow.
Field of Dreams is more emotionally moving than Star Wars.
Well, that's just true.
Yeah. Also, controversial opinion. Okay, I won't go that far. I was going to say that Star Trek is just better than Star Wars, but that's a whole discussion I don't think you guys are ready to have. I don't think you all are ready to have.
I'm not sure if that actually stands up to scrutiny. That would be a really interesting conversation.
Well, the question is the worst of Star Trek worse than the worst of Star Wars?
Probably.
You think that there's something in Star Trek worse than the holiday special of Star Wars?
Okay, but the holiday special is a masterpiece, so I don't know what you're talking about.
I see. We're dealing with someone here. that's another podcast.
Don't you love the Wookiee family holiday?
Oh, I love the scene where Chewbacca's dad watches Smut, VR Smut.
I mean,
that's my favorite Star Wars.
You know, like, The Simpsons predicted everything? Well, you know, the holiday special predicted that.
It did predict VR chat. Yeah, that is true.
Yeah, so, you know, put some respect on its name.
That's fair enough, I suppose.
What are we doing here? This is the Galaxy Geekdom podcast, and we are doing our little mini-series on a very different movie, on the Exorcist franchise. Now, last week we covered the original 1973 classic, and all of us, I'm surprisingly even Jazzy liked it this time.
This is a great movie. This one is not a great movie.
So yeah, we've moved on to The Exorcist 2, The Heretic, which is a masterpiece of cinema. It is the greatest film ever. And they totally made a better movie than the first one, because the first one is terrible and this one was so much better, right?
Oh, Crystal, actually, I think I may have to, you know, cut you off there. Have you ever gone to the Wikipedia page, The Worst Movies of All Time?
No, I have not actually visited that particular page.
Right, right. Well, on that page, there is a section
Kane?
For the 70s. There's a section for the 70s. And among the films of the worst of that decade, Exodus to the Heretic is listed as one of the absolute worst films of all time. And if you can't trust Wikipedia, who can you trust?
The government?
Your eyes. You can trust your eyes when you watch this entry in the franchise. And I'll be honest with you. It is a great guideline of what never to do in a sequel. Just everything. Yeah, no,
now to drop the act, it was pretty god-awful.
This is one of the worst. Like, here's the thing. People always complain, oh, you know, Marvel's dropped off in quality. Oh, you know, the Star Wars prequels, they're pretty bad. I myself have been quoted as saying that second one especially. But none of them have ever come close to the strangeness of Exorcist 2. Like, it's not just that it's bad. It's not just that it's, like, not good. It's bizarrely not good. It's so bad. What I'm about to tell you is true, by the way. One of the sneak previews for Exorcist 2, when the film first came out, a bunch of studio heads went to the premiere wanting to have a sneak preview of the reaction of the audience. And, you know, they're so confident in their film that they tell the limo driver, hey, limo driver, go get some fast food. So the limo driver leaves and they go inside the theater. They enter the auditorium, and within 10 minutes of the film, one of the audience members gets up and goes, hey, the people who made this, and I'm going to quote this right now, who made this piece of shit movie are in this room. About 12 people got up and started to chase the executives out of the theater. And the executives, realizing that they told the limo driver to leave to get food, were left without a car. So they had to run down the street, run down multiple streets, as the audience of the film chased them in protest of this movie. That is a true story that actually happened.
That's kind of an amazing story, because I always love executives getting...
Oh, 100%. I don't care if they suffer. Like, if a film director or film writer, that's different. But when it comes to an executive, let them have it.
Wow, that is incredible.
This movie was so bad, they had to pull it from theaters and hastily recut the whole film, getting scenes actually out of order in the recut before putting it back in theaters.
So, the version that is available on Max and stuff is definitely the recut version, correct?
I don't think they've ever released the other version.
Oh, okay.
Outside of its, like, limited theater run.
There are so many weird old movies that, like, have different versions, so I never know which cut, you know.
Like, with the Exorcist series, like, recuts is almost like a tradition. Like, every film has, like, its alternate cut out there. But no one has had enough interest in Exorcist 2 to restore, like, the three-hour version.
Somebody, they did their best to restore to restore Exorcist 3, which is next week's one.
Oh, yeah.
But they didn't do enough care to try and restore Exorcist 2.
Well, in fairness,
very curious what the changes is. I need to go through an entire list, or if there's a video on it.
Well, what if I told you there was an extra hour of the film they cut out?
Well, that is even more fascinating. I kind of love that, though.
But, like, none of it had any relevancy in the plot. It was all, long, drawn-out pauses between dialogue.
Was there a plot?
I didn't say plot, I said dialogue.
Oh, okay.
And, like, extra lines that added nothing.
Well, that's just rule number one when you want to make a really great movie.
Right? It's just bad. It's just not good.
No, this movie only has bad.
This movie only has one fan, and it's Martin Scorsese. Martin Scorsese actually likes this movie. In fact, he said it. He liked the themes of the movie.
Okay.
Which, I mean,
I guess he's allowed a wrong opinion.
Yeah, I agree. Like, he ranks it as one of his biggest guilty pleasures. So at least he knows it's the wrong opinion as well.
There are some interesting elements. It just doesn't come together.
That's the thing. This movie has a lot of clever and interesting ideas, but I think at best they just fail to become anything meaningful, and at worst actually undercut the merits of the original film.
What? It's so weird because it so wants to be its own thing, but it's also so rooted in the original that it's like it doesn't know what it wants to be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's
like the entire last half of the movie taking place in the same house. Was that really necessary? Or what? Was that more just like a continuation of said fan service?
Well, the funniest thing about that is that the director, John Borman, is not a fan of the movie. In fact, he hated the original Exorcist.
Yeah, I know that. Which is, I know what I mean is that it's just fascinating that it still resolves in a sequence that's just like, oh, this is the same house.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, you know, the other funny thing about this movie is, that's technically not the same house from the first film. Like, in the plot of the film it is, but the people who own the original location refuse to allow them to film there.
Okay.
So they had to rebuild the whole house.
They rebuilt the entire house?
Yeah, in a sound studio, apparently.
Okay, because it did look like a set. It definitely did.
Yeah, it doesn't look real. None of the sets, none of this movie is on location. It's all sets. I think, like, all of it.
I think what I mean, not like behind the scenes wise, but literally like location wise, it is the same. The same house, just yeah. Not.
Actually, I just lied. Everything's a set except for the balcony. The one where Linda Blair is just walking without a railing at the very edge of like a precipice over a city street.
Wait,
that's real.
That was real.
That was real. There were no nets, by the way, in case you were wondering that. They just actually put Linda Blair like at the edge of like a balcony without any railings, and just said, "Okay, just walk up to the edge and start teetering over it."
That sounds like a very 70s thing to do.
Yeah. Linda Blair was not in a good place with these movies. I'm not sure what's worse though. William Friedkin permanently injuring her with like a harness, or John Borman just almost dropping her off like a building. I don't know what is worse. They're both awful.
Or the abuse that she suffered from people sending her hate mail.
Yeah. Agreed. Very much agreed. So, to avoid talking about the plot further, do you know who was the first choice to direct this film?
I do not know that. I don't know much about behind the scenes, so I'm very curious.
Oh, I did my homework on this one because this film is... I had to know.
The assignment. I watched it and tried to recuperate my life afterwards.
I had to know how this film got made. I just had to. So the original choice that Warner Brothers had for this film was none other than Stanley Kubrick.
Huh.
Yeah, they went to Stanley Kubrick and were like, yeah, do you want to do The Exorcist 2? And he was like, no, I actually don't want to do The Exorcist 2.
Yeah, and that's a very Kubrick thing, too.
He's like, no, I don't, actually.
Okay. Actually, now I would have liked to have seen what he did with The Exorcist 2.
Well, that's the funny thing, too, about this film. Apparently, the original script for the film was actually pretty good.
Well, that's sad, then.
Yeah. But when John Borman got involved, he was like, yeah, I don't like any of this. I'm going to change it.
So what we're learning is that he has terrible taste?
Well, he did make Zardoz right after this.
Okay, yeah. I've not seen that.
Oh, Zardoz is a masterpiece of cinema. It's so great.
I should definitely put it on my list. I'll definitely watch it soon. I'm not lying at all.
It's a movie where a giant floating head vomits out rifles while shouting out that the gun is good and the penis is evil. Also, Sean Connery's there.
Well, that sounds like That's amazing.
I'm not gonna lie, I actually do love Zardoz. It's terrible, but like it's terrible in a very fun way. I guess we have to talk about this movie, don't we?
We have to talk about this. We have to talk about Exorcist, yes.
Okay. Crystal, I will sit back as you try to explain Exorcist 2 to me. A movie I have seen, unfortunately, more than once.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. So, Crystal, what happens in The Exorcist 2, The Heretic?
I kind of wish I fucking knew. Reagan is a few years later, and obviously Reagan is trying to, well...
What is Reagan trying to do?
Basically, I guess she's put in a facility where she's getting psychological help for the trauma that she experienced in the first film, with the exorcism thing, and that was a bad thing. That was kind of a bad thing. Kind of a bad day.
I would say not a good situation for her.
Yeah. It was not a good thing. Not the worst. I mean, she could be doing taxes. That's like way worse, but you know.
Yeah, in fairness, 12-year-old doing taxes is pretty terrible.
Yeah. By the way, before we move on from this, what the fuck is with the facility that they're at?
Right? I was watching it with my spouse, and we're both like, what is treating here? Because, like, I counted a few of the different things. And my spouse, by the way, is a special education teacher. So we have some background in terms of, some common disabilities, common things that need to be treated on with a facility like this. And we saw someone with an ocular implant, so deafness. We saw multiple people with autism, multiple people with like muscular dystrophy, and we saw Reagan, who has nothing actually more than PTSD, except not really, because it never really manifests in the whole movie. She just was possessed, is kind of aware of it, but it seems to have no lasting trauma or impact on her beyond the demon actually impacting her life. There's no mental effects for it. It's the demon still there.
Like the people around her are more impacted by it than she is.
Oh, yeah, entirely. Like, there's people with but like in the facility, you're treating PTSD alongside physical ailments and learning disabilities.
Yeah, this felt really, really fucking ableist, gotta say.
Oh, horribly so. I mean, wait, Crystal. Are you implying that Reagan being able to cure autism is ableist? Just tell people to talk more. That'll cure the horrible ailment that is autism, apparently. Like, the ableism in this movie is outrageous.
It is insane, and I'm going to say it's honestly the scariest part about the movie.
Mm. Agreed with that. There was no
scary thing, but watching that, like the thing that they consider quote-unquote normal, was fucking terrifying.
Honestly, yeah. No, it's terrifying. This also has maybe the worst depiction of, like, a priest in any of these movies.
Are you talking about the lead priest for this movie?
Yes,
name
Richard Burton.
Escaped me?
Richard Burton's character. By the way, do you know why Richard Burton's in this movie?
No, I do not. I don't know anything.
Okay, so what you have to know with Richard Burton is that he was very famously married to Elizabeth Taylor.
Okay.
They had a very intense relationship. And during this time, they were getting divorced. I believe not for the first time, but or maybe not the last time. I can't remember for sure. But Richard Burton desperately needed money, and so signed on to the first movie that would give him a paycheck over a certain size. That movie was Exorcist 2.
Okay, that's valid though. I get it. I mean, I get it. You know.
Now that being said, every day he came to set, Richard Burton was drunk.
Couldn't tell.
Oh, yeah, couldn't tell, right? Now, also at the same time, unfortunately, Linda Blair was dealing with drug addiction. So she was high every day on set.
And you can tell.
Yeah. So we have drunk Richard Burton and high Linda Blair acting through a script that was rewritten on the fly when they came to set that day.
Directed by a man who famously hated the original film.
Yeah. This is a recipe for success.
I don't see how anything could go wrong.
Oh, yeah. So, Crystal, let me ask you a question. What is Richard Burton doing in this film?
I don't know.
Yeah, right.
He does this weird telepathy thingy with that, like, semi-futuristic machine.
Oh,
that
God,
they
yeah.
They'll strap into. And then he sees everything that happens in the original film, but like we also see a sequence where we didn't see in the original film with Father Mer, Father Marin again.
Yeah, but why is he even here? Like, what is?
And by the
point?
Way, the makeup on Regan, like possessed Regan, worse. It's just worse.
I got another trivia fact about that.
Okay.
Another thing for that. So apparently Linda Blair was so uncomfortable with the original film that for one reason or another, she refused to ever be put in the makeup for Reagan as when she's possessed ever again.
That's so valid.
Oh yeah, valid. And again, there's a lot of reasons for this. Linda Blair went through a really horrible period of time immediately following the Exorcist because of just various factors. So valid. So every time you see Reagan in the makeup in this film, it's another actress.
That's
it's not
what
Linda
I
Blair.
Kind of thought. It didn't really look like her.
Yeah, you can tell, though. It doesn't look a thing like her.
I'm just saying the makeup in addition to it is also bad.
Oh, it's the worst. It's, and I think the worst scene, there's a close-up of her towards the end, but I think the worst scene involving Reagan is during that weird dual hypno thing when you see like the superimposed shot of Reagan as like the with Pazuzu in her grabbing yes. Nurse Ratched's heart and strangling her.
Oh, it's very strange.
Bizarre. Also, Nurse Ratched's in this movie, which just makes this really
right.
bizarre.
I know, I watched it, I'm like, oh, that's her. Okay.
I'm like watching this, like what, Louise Fletcher? I'm like, I'm watching this movie and I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot Nurse Ratched's in here. I'm sorry, she can't be anything but Nurse Ratched. That's just who she is. That's who she is forever, unfortunately.
I'm very curious why they would have someone who went through a traumatic experience have access to a balcony that has no fucking railings.
Right? And not just, like, no railings, but, like, gaps in, like, the glass panels they have up.
There's gaps in the railings.
Like, who designed this?
First of all, who designed that?
Yeah, like, all it takes a good gust one day to send you curdling down to your doom. Like, it doesn't take much. I'm clumsy. I walk outside there once, I'm falling down. Not even intentionally.
Sleepwalking?
It's a trip. Yeah, sleepwalking, another thing. And she's just allowed to open up the doors. No supervision, nothing. She's like, she's not even a legal adult. She's 17, I think, in this movie. Like, oh, by the way, one other thing about that. Before I get too sidetracked, because I will. There's so much about this film that's bizarre. There is a scene later on where there's two Reagans, because that's not confusing at all. One of them tries to seduce Richard Burton's character, who's a 50-year-old man, and she's 17.
Oh, yeah, that was extremely uncomfortable.
Oh, but do you know what the crazy thing about that scene is? What? Apparently, the scene was much more explicit. Like, much, much more. And there was supposed to be multiple scenes of this.
But
both Linda Blair and Richard Burton were so profoundly uncomfortable with this, they refused to even show up on set if they did that. If they were going to do those scenes.
I mean, valid. Right?
I can't blame them. I really can't blame them. Like, what was this movie?
Someone's drug trip.
Right? But I love how at this point we haven't even described what the plot of the film
is. I'm keeping sidetracked because there's just so many weird things in it.
So what even is Richard Burton doing here?
I know Richard Burton is initially sent to go investigate. I'm trying to remember every detail because it's been like a few days since I saw this.
Right,
I know the magic of podcasting. I'm not like Jazzy, where Jazzy watches it the day of.
So, if I remember correctly, he is there to investigate why Father Marin died because for some reason they think the man who died fighting a demon is a secret Satanist, and he died fighting a demon because so. The priest has to go in to investigate why Father Marin died, which he finds out in the first weird dual hypnotism thing. He finds out exactly why he got exactly how and why Father Marin died, so he could just leave. His mission's complete. He did the job. Like, so why are you still here? Like, what are you doing?
Like, if the movie was written better, they could have given him reasons for him to stay.
Right? Like, I think the idea is supposed to be that he becomes fascinated by the idea of a demon and, like, becomes obsessed with it. And, like, that brings him down a rabbit hole. But, like, there's no reason for him to do so. He's already done possessions. Like, he's done exorcisms. He's seen demons before. Like, he's supposedly a student of Father Marin's, too, supposedly. Like, why is he still going off and looking for this thing? He did his job perfectly well within the first half hour of the film. In theory, that should be it.
But it's not. And the movie's not over.
No, it's like an hour and a half left. Oh, by the way, what'd you think of Richard Burton's ability to put out a fire?
By hitting it as hard as he could?
He did
a great job.
He's like, no, there's a fire somewhere in the building. Goes downstairs, sees a box smoldering. His instinct is to throw the box into the center of the room, take a crutch, and just whack it.
I mean, that'll get it out eventually, right?
I mean, it just spreads the fire all around, to the point where there's, like, fire behind his head.
Which is what she drew. You know?
Yeah, like, Reagan foresaw it happening, because she also realized Richard Burton does not know how to put out a fire.
She was testing him.
Oh, I see. So Crystal, who set the fire?
I would say the goblins that live in this facility.
Like, you never explained that.
I guess Pazuzu?
I mean, but here's the crazy thing about this movie with Pazuzu. Like, yes, they name Pazuzu as Pazuzu in this film, as opposed to in the book where he is just Pazuzu, but not in the film. Anyway. But, like, does Pazuzu actually really do anything in this film? Like, what does he actually do in the whole film?
He acts as a symbol for their fear, I suppose, and the possession that happened. I don't know.
I think the idea that great evil is drawn towards great good actually undermines the entire original film so much. Like, the idea
giving characters telekinetic powers, I guess.
Yeah, that too. So, like, Reagan can cure autism with her mind, much like how Kakumo, the character played by James Earl Jones, as a kid can stop locusts by twirling his hand in the air. And so demons are drawn to the really good people because they want to stop the really good people from doing good, which completely contradicts the reason Father Marin gave at the end of the first film, which I thought was a perfect explanation for why demons do what they do, just to make people despair. Like, there's no higher meaning, there's no war, they just want to make people feel like they're miserable and isolated. And that's way more terrifying and way more understandable than, say, no, also the demons are less... stopping Super Avengers.
Yeah, it's way less black and white, good versus evil.
Yeah, it's like, more... Sick. I'm sorry, I cut you off there.
No, you're good. I'm just saying it's way more simple.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, 100%. And the other problem, I think, with it, too, is that Reagan is supposed to be just anyone. She's supposed to be any girl in the United States, just innocent, living, naive, and gets horribly tortured by this demon. To say that she's supposed to be this big messiah, I think, actually reduces her character, because it boils her down to, like, this Masonic figure, when really she's just some girl. And the fact that she's just a very rich girl, yes, but she's just someone. And, like, that element of this can happen to anyone, you can be doing nothing wrong, and your life is destroyed because some outside force is deliberately invades and exploits you. Like, that's terrifying. To say the demon is scared of you because of your magic locus-stopping abilities and your ability to cure autism, and you're the specialist girl whoever lived, like, something about that makes her feel less interesting to me. Like, it makes her into, like, this figurehead for
things. It doesn't help that she's written, like, so poorly and so blandly.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, my God, yeah. Well, I mean, can you tell that they rewrote the script, like, on the spot before filming?
You can absolutely tell.
Oh, I love the scene where she's talking to the girl whose autism she cures. I really can't move past the fact that there's an Exorcist film. Linda Blair cures autism by smiling. It's just, but she's like, tells the girl, like, oh yeah, I was possessed by a demon, but don't worry, I'm better now. It's all right. I'm like, what is this movie?
It's a movie written on the set.
God, yeah. Oh, and by the way, in case you're curious, no, neither Exorcist prequel is even remotely like this in terms of their flashback scenes.
Oh, so for you, you're talking about for that when we get to that.
Yeah, when we get to that, both versions of the Exorcist prequel ignored everything to do with this film.
Okay, well, that's probably for the best.
Yeah, I think it is. Because I mean, your mileage may vary on this, but I don't think this film was particularly an accurate portrayal of African culture at all.
Are you saying that white filmmakers in the 70s didn't know how to portray African culture in a film?
You know what? Shockingly, I may be implying that, yeah.
Wow.
So first off, where in Africa is this?
It's in Rockland, where there's rocks everywhere, and you have to climb rocks to get to
places. Exactly. Secondly, what was with that temple? Like, at one point, we have Father Marin performing an exorcism on the side of a rock wall. And just being, like, they're dangling from, like, the wall. It's, like, five or six priests. And the one guy falls. And everyone, in the then present, everyone's like, yeah, the one guy fell from the tower. We don't know what happened to him. He fell down the rock wall. We don't know where he went. Could he be at the bottom of the rock wall? And then Richard Burton, he's right
down
there.
They found his body. He's right there. Have you tried looking where he fell?
Yeah. It's like, did you try? Did you look? Like, oh my God, I can't believe you found him at the bottom of the wall.
I guess in this movie, they need the white guy to show them how to do anything.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, not racist at all.
No, not in the least bit. Not in the least bit. Also, every single, like, the fact that this, like, ancient Christian, vividly Christian temple is in Africa. Like the most ancient of holy grounds, apparently. Like, one of the oldest places in the whole faith. is in Africa, a continent, not a country, but a continent that was heavily colonized by European settlers, none of whom, by the way, were Catholic. Like, it was put out there with none of whom, but very few were Catholic. It was primarily the French, who had ties to both the Catholic Church and the Protestant faith. The Germans were mostly Protestant. The English were Anglican. And the Italians, I think they got, like, a couple places. And this place is supposed to be, like, super ancient Catholic.
Yeah.
Like, how does that make any sense whatsoever from, like, a historical standpoint?
I don't think they looked in the history book at all.
I don't think so either. And especially, like, and there's so much about their depiction of Africa that's just terrible. Like, the fact that they need Ned Beatty to show up and be like, oh, yeah, I know where this village that you're describing is. It's right in here. I'm going to take you there. And I'm pretty sure Ned Beatty was only in this movie because of Deliverance, which was also made by John Borman.
Right.
In which Ned Beatty, well, if you've seen Deliverance, you know exactly what I'm referring to. But let's just say that maybe this is a step up in terms of horrible things happening to Ned Beatty being in The Exorcist 2. And I'll leave it at that. But,
I'm familiar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So.
I've not seen the movie, but I'm familiar with what happens.
Yeah, it's a movie. I don't know if it's a good or bad movie, and I've seen it. I don't know if it's excellent or just embarrassing, but it's both, maybe at the same time.
It sounds better than this.
Yeah. Oh, well, The Deliverance is actually competently made and coherent. That already gives it a big plus over everything else in this film.
Didn't you love the scenes or multiple scenes of the POV shot of the locust?
Oh my God, they love locusts in this film. The locusts are like the core theme of the film because they argue that, you know, once the locust brushes its wings against another locust, they become like insane. But only the brushing of the wings of a good locust can restore order. That's what James Earl Jones told me. And I don't care enough about locusts to prove him wrong.
You like the whole sequence when you see James Earl Jones and he, like, he's wearing a beautiful locust costume. And
I do love that scene.
He tells him to step across the pit of spikes, and it goes through the very obviously fake foot.
Well, that's after he spits, like, a peach or something onto the friggin' spikes. And then he just wakes up in Kokomo's lab, and he's like, oh, hello, I'm Kokomo. I'm going to explain locusts to you.
It's actually, he's like, well, you know that, like, weirdly racist depiction? Well, this is not actually the truth. This is a lab.
I would love it if the secret message of the scene was just that Richard Burton was so incredibly racist that he was looking at, like, you know, like a fairly, like, industrious area and was like, oh my God, the mud huts. I can't believe, oh my God, there's brothels everywhere. Meanwhile, he's like looking at, like, a Starbucks and just being like, oh my God, I can't believe.
I would respect the film more if that was the approach they were taking.
But you know, that's not it. You know that I don't think John Borman understands that Africa is not just 80% mud huts.
You mean he doesn't understand that Africa is an entire continent with multiple countries with different perspectives, cultures, traditions, history?
I love how he just refers to Africa as just, I have to go to Africa. I'm like, okay, where in Africa? You don't say you have to go to Europe.
Even Reagan in her vision, the vision thing, she's like, I think it's in Africa. We learned about it in our school.
Yeah, but at least Reagan's 17 years old and dumb.
Yeah, at least as a kid. You know, it makes sense.
You can make the justification. Like, you can make justification going like, yeah, no, that's in Africa, I'm pretty sure. We read about it. She didn't have to charter a flight to the specific airport. It's like, yeah, tell the travel agent, I want to go to Africa. Like, okay, is that Timbuktu, Egypt, Sudan, South Africa, Uganda, like Libya? Where are we going exactly? The Congo?
There's a lot of places there.
Yeah, it's a pretty big continent, actually. It's like, and James Earl Jones is wasted in this movie. Like, he's entertaining, but like, he's by and mm-hmm. far one of the most talented actors in this whole movie.
And actually, 100%. He probably, like, his scenes are competently acted. You know, yeah. Like, he does his job. You can tell he's talented. Mm-hmm. You know.
He brings a gravitas to him sitting in a locust costume saying, fuck my Pazuzu. Like, he makes that sound like noble and Shakespearean.
He does his best.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that, you know, Linda Blair, you know, due, of course, to circumstances outside of her control in part, and Richard Burton and, you know, Nurse Ratched, like, they all kind of half-ass this movie. I think Max von Sydow just does what he did in the first film consistently. So, no, kudos there.
He's just fine. Yeah, he's fine.
He's in a couple scenes. He just has to do a couple things. He's good. The only one I think, like, actually, like, worked to get to make sure they earn their paycheck is James Earl Jones. Because
I feel like that's just the thing he does, though. You know what I mean?
Every time. He doesn't put half an effort into any role he's ever been in.
Well, and I also think it seemed like he realized what type of movie he was in. He was in a sequel to a hugely popular movie. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't surprise me that he would try to show, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I find it funny how, like, this is a movie with multiple Shakespearean actors. Like, I'd say half the cast are Shakespearean actors. And only one of them is putting in an effort.
It's true.
Yeah. So, here's the thing about The Exorcist. You would expect it to be some possession, right?
Mm-hmm.
Outside of the flashbacks with Kakumo, does anyone actually get possessed in this movie? Does Reagan get possessed? Because it's more like there's an evil Reagan and a good Reagan, and the bad Reagan gets her heart ripped out. And last I checked, exorcisms don't involve the heart being ripped from the torso of the possessed.
I'm also confused by Richard Burton, because, like, there's a good period where he just kind of turns into, like, this weird zombie.
Yeah. And it's never explained either. Like, at first I thought he was possessed, but, like, he has to be seduced by the demon, which implies that he's not possessed. He's just really excited to be there, I guess. Like, I don't get this movie. What is this?
It totally makes sense. It is a completely it's a completely understandable movie.
Okay, so I have here a quote from John Boorman from 2005.
Whoa, 2005, okay.
2005. So we have John Boorman looking back on Exorcist 2. And this is
the greatest movie.
So, Sir John Boorman. I'm sorry. He was knighted. Probably for Zardoz, I'm sure. And it goes, it all comes down to audience expectations. The film that I made, I saw as a kind of repoussé to the ugliness and darkness of the original Exorcist. I wanted a film about journeys that was positive, about good, essentially. And I think that audiences, in hindsight, were right. I denied them what they wanted, and they were pissed off about it. Quite rightly, I knew I wasn't giving them what they wanted, and it was a really foolish choice. So, that's John Boorman admitting he made a bad decision. But I just want to ask, was this a movie about positive and good choices?
That's a... No.
No, I don't think so. It's just, what is he talking about? When I think of this movie, I think of locusts flying, Linda Blair in a weird light machine, weird, like, double vision hallucinations of Reagan and not Reagan, in, like, grabbing Nurse Ratched's heart. The weirdest case of mountain climbing I've ever seen. And just James Earl Jones in the second goofiest costume he wore in the 70s, right behind that other one where he wore all black, that weird all black phase of his. Well, he didn't actually wear that, he just voiced it. That's Darth Vader's a whole other discussion. Like what is this film?
The feeling I'm getting while doing this is this is the weirdest film of the series we're going to be covering in terms of just being bad, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, this is the strangest, most baffling entry in this franchise. Like, you can make an argument that any of these films, aside from Exorcist 3, were not as good as the original. Or at least not comparable to the original in terms of quality. But Exorcist 2 is just, like, this is just bizarre.
It's like when you see someone who's, like, really good at, like, juggling, and then you throw those items to the second person to catch, and that person just fumbles everything.
I have another quote. This time from William Friedkin.
I bet it's a very lovely quote.
So this is his response when he recalled years later watching the film. He says, "I was at Technicolor, and a guy said, 'We just finished a print of Exorcist 2. Do you want to have a look at it?' And I looked at half an hour of it, and I thought it was as bad as seeing a traffic accident in the street. It was horrible. It's just a stupid mess made by a dumb guy, Sir John Borman by name, somebody who should be nameless, but in this case should be named. Skrillis, a horrible picture, one of the worst I've ever seen. That film was made by a demented mind."
She liked it, is what I'm getting.
Yeah, oh, yeah, of course. That's exactly the message you take from that. By contrast, William Peter Blatty was asked what he thought of the film, but he could not actually be quoted because he just started laughing at the question.
That's a valid response.
Yeah. What is this movie?
Audience who's listening to this, who has never seen it, if you want to submit yourself to this, it is available to stream on Max.
So why you'd want to watch it is the bigger question.
The bigger question I have right now is why hasn't there been a release from Rift Tracks of this movie?
That's a good question. Considering that in the famous book, The Golden Turkey Awards, it was voted the second worst movie of all time. The fact that Rift Tracks hasn't jumped on this is probably because of licensing from Warner Brothers, I can imagine.
Yeah, but they can do an MP3 riff. They don't have to get permission.
That's true. That's very true.
That's how I watched their Rift Tracks of Cats.
That's fair. That's a fair point. I lied. So apparently, Shout Factory did release the director's cut version of this film.
Oh, okay.
Yes, Shout Factory has a cut of it, actually, on Blu-ray. I've just never seen it. But I was just reading up on, as we're talking, what was included in the alternate cut. And I'm reading this off of the IMDb trivia section. So if you want me to, I can tell you what's in it. Sure. Basically, scenes were shortened, scenes were rearranged, lines of dialogue were cut, music cues were altered, And bizarrely, in the reverse Blade Runner, there was narration by Richard Burton in the beginning of the film.
Oh.
And bizarrely also, it implied that Richard Burton died at the climax of the film, as opposed to in this movie where he's walking around in the very last scene of the film.
Weird.
Also, Sharon, one of the three returning characters in the first film, is not burned alive.
Oh.
So.
There you go.
Bizarrely, that's really not much to the film, which is kind of
so there's a 118-minute cut of the movie, mm-hmm. and there's a 102-minute cut of the film.
And somehow the 180-minute cut only has those significant changes.
Okay, so,
So why was it, like, essentially 80 minutes of content just cutting out those bits of those concepts? Like, I feel like it was a lot of empty stuff if they cut it that easily and nothing else significantly changed but the story.
I could have sworn I saw the one on... Okay. I'm a little confused because I'm reading the Shout Factory release of it, and I feel like that the 118 minute cut is the version I saw on Max.
And yeah, the longer version I would say is on Max.
Yeah, but the shorter ones, huh?
But we didn't have like the narration on Max or
no.
Or like, and I definitely, and Sharon definitely was burning up in that. Also, why did they kill, what logical sense does the whole burning yourself make if she's not possessed? She just sort of is there and lights herself on fire?
That was confusing too. Was she possessed or was she not?
Cause like, you know, she's in the case.
She says like
possessed.
She gave in to evil or something.
But like, what does that mean? like, what does it mean you gave in to evil? Like, you didn't, you were fine up until you walked in. Like, it's not like The Omen where, like, Pazuzu doesn't function like Damien in The Omen where, you know, he shows up and, you know, there's some demonic power that causes, like, buildings to fall down on top of you or, like, Or lightning strikes across and it plummets down, or a sheet of glass cuts your head off. It's like, in The Exorcist, the only reason characters die, Burke is shoved out a window and his head is twisted around by Reagan. Reagan directly, if this film is to be believed, causes Father Marin's heart attack. And Father Karras throws himself out a window. So, like, it doesn't make any sense that the demon would be powerful enough to cause, like, anything outside of that when it doesn't even seem like its intention to do so. Like, all the deaths seem incidental.
Seems like in this one, Pazuzu's power is weirdly infinite.
And also very small, too, because all...
Yeah.
He can do is send, like, locusts into a room.
It's like the guy who tries to be a supervillain but comes up with the most lame shit you can find.
Which is really strange considering they call Pazuzu, like, the spirit of the wind. But, like, in mythology, Pazuzu is a fertility spirit. Like, that's why he has a big dick. Because he's a fertility god.
Uh-huh.
That's why his statue is like the giant erect penis, because he's a fertility god.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so it's like, I don't know. Everything about this film is so bizarre and so strange, and I don't understand anything that...
I don't even know.
So I just Googled it on just out of curiosity on Wikipedia, and it does say he was considered as both a destructive and dangerous wind.
Okay, so that at least makes some sense. I just know he's like a big.
But also as a repellent to other demons. Interesting.
Mm.
He would safeguard the home from their influence. He was protective of pregnant women and mothers.
There we go. So, like, he was worn as an amulet. And he actually referenced that in the first film. They have the scene where, at the beginning of the film, when Father Marin is doing the dig in I think it's like Iraq, and they find the mm-hmm. symbol of Pazuzu mm-hmm. in the dig, and that's meant to be an amulet to protect someone. They refer to it as evil against evil, but it's like back then they saw him as more demons were not exactly seen as pure evil; it was more like a concept.
So even the original one is kind of weird with how they take the Pazuzu demon.
But you have to read it from the perspective of the Catholics. It was a popular trend throughout Catholic history to take other cultures' gods and spirits and demons and make them into personifications of evil. Like, you see the same thing with Pan and other nature spirits who have goat horns in folklore. Their likeness right. becomes the basis of Asmodeus, of Satan, of Lucifer. So it makes sense that Blatty would continue that trend with Pazuzu, especially choosing a Mesopotamian entity because that was where the early Israelites used to be. So it makes sense from a theological perspective why Blatty chose Pazuzu specifically. It's just funny he chose that particular entity, knowing the mythological connotations of Pazuzu itself. And the book does say Pazuzu quite a lot. Like, the original novel directly calls him Pazuzu. But in this film, whenever they say Pazuzu, it sounds so goofy.
Yeah. Well, it's a fun word to say.
Yeah,
I'm going to be honest.
It's a goofy sounding name. And like, I feel like it's not shocking that they rarely say the name Pazuzu in any of the follow-ups to The Exorcist after Exorcist 2.
That actually makes a lot of sense.
Like, they're deliberately vague about it because like the name Pazuzu is so goofy and so silly.
It does kind of take away from the mysterious elements of it, for sure. Yeah. Like, if it was a nebulous, like, demonic being, that's almost a better concept than having a directly named Mesopotamian demonic entity that is actually known for doing good things.
Exactly. 100%. I don't know. This whole movie is bizarre. Like, this whole film is strange. Everything about this movie is baffling me. I think my brain is breaking trying to explain The Exorcist 2 to any human being.
I think the fact that it doesn't name him really much in the first film makes it far more interesting.
Yeah, because the demon's a liar. They don't say, he calls himself the devil. They even point out that the demon calling himself the devil is like someone claiming they're like Napoleon. You know, it's meant to be ridiculous and absurd, but also you don't know if he's lying. Like, we know he says half-truths, truths and lies, but like, you know, we don't know where the lies begin and the truths end. This is totally separate, but I was just reading Pet Cemetery, the novel. I like reading some scary books for Halloween, so I was reading Pet Cemetery. And
we talked about that.
Well, oh, yeah, it's a great, great book. And
yeah,
what's funny is at the end of the book, when they actually cut this out of every version of Pet Cemetery, that the people who come back, they don't just attack people, they're not just feral. They also say things that are meant to be, like, emotionally harmful to the people around them.
Like, yeah, that's the scariest part of that book.
Oh yeah, genuinely disturbing. There's a scene where like Gage tells like Judd, who's like the old man who's played by Herman Munster, that, you know, your wife had sex with everyone in town and she's burning in hell, you know, and she has arthritis and, you know, every other thing. And you don't know if what the kid's saying has any basis in reality. You just know it's designed to hurt this person emotionally at like the core of his being. And like in The Exorcist, the same thing happens, you know, when Reagan, who's possessed, she goes like, you know, she keeps talking to Karis about his mother and like says, your mother's in here, Karis, burning, you know, it's just, and then starts talking in Italian to cause the, you know, the trauma to become fresh. You know, what would you do? Why you do this to me? Oh, you know, and like in this film, there's never a hint that Pazuzu has any desire to actually emotionally hurt people. Like, he's more interested explaining how strong he is. He tells, you know, Marion at the first drop of a hat what his name is. He monologues to Reagan about, like, how once I got you, that's it. You're mine forever. Ah, you know. There's nothing there that's as cruel or as sadistic or as mean as the demon in like the original film or Exorcist 3, as you'll see next week. But Crystal, I have a question for you. Did any scene in this movie scare you?
Oh, not at all.
Not even close, right?
There's nothing scary in the movie.
Like it's a horror film. Isn't it a prerequisite that you have to be scary?
Honestly, it was more boring at times.
I think the only moment that came close to being scary is a single shot of the film. It's where you see, like, Reagan almost like she's melting into frame. Like, it's this weird transition where, like, everything's scrunched and, like, unscrunching in front of you.
Huh.
And it's such a surreal visual. It's towards like the last third of the film, last half, fourth of the film. It's such a surreal visual. And it's so brief that the only reason I remember it exists is because whenever they'd air this movie on TV, they'd use that one shot to pretend the film was a horror film. It's like such an arresting visual, but it's also like, so brief and so ephemeral, it just comes and goes, and it's like, what is this?
That was my reaction to the whole movie, by the way. What is this?
Yeah, I'm sorry if I'm rambling too much, but this movie is just so bizarre to me. I also, what is with the tap dancing scene?
I guess they're connected through their powers.
I guess, maybe. Oh, by the way, this movie does have a tie with a more successful film.
Oh?
So, the soundtrack for Exorcist 2 was done by Ennio Morricone, who did Good, yes. Mad, the Ugly, and The Thing. There's a song from this film that's in The Hateful Eight. Tarantino's The Hateful Eight.
Yeah, I saw it.
Yeah, there's a scene, there's a song from this movie in that film.
I just haven't seen that in a while, so I don't remember which one.
Neither do I, but it's in there. Along with, like, I think the Thing soundtrack. There's some weird song cues in that movie.
Hmm.
But it's like...
strange.
I just don't understand this film. I just... There are decisions in this film that, like, I just don't get why they were made, what drove Borman to make them, and what was going on in anyone's head while this film was being produced.
Not drugs.
I guess that's the only sane explanation for this. But I do love how John Borman wanted to make The Lord of the Rings after this.
Oh, wow. His Lord of the Rings would have been interesting.
Well, we have an idea what it would have looked like, because he didn't make Lord of the Rings, but he made another fantasy film in the 80s that he's more famous for. One that your favorite filmmaker of all time, Zack Snyder, draws heavily from and references in most of his films.
Excalibur.
Excalibur. This is made by the same guy who did Excalibur.
Which I heard is a much better movie.
It's a much better movie, but you can also tell it's made by the same guy. He's the best way of putting it. Borman's skills are not really in, like, character writing.
I can tell that, for sure.
Yeah, Borman is better at coming up with these wild ideas and putting them on camera. And the more the film allows him to play with big ideas, the better they are. The Exorcist is just not that movie. Like, The Exorcist is a movie with big ideas told through human perspectives, like told on a human level. This film is just, everything about it just upsets me, and I'm angry that it exists.
That's valid. I think this is probably the most annoyed we're going to be at a movie watching this through this whole marathon. I'm glad we hit like the high and then the low.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. From here on out, it's a mixed bag. I will say, Exorcist Believer apparently isn't all that good either.
I still think it's better than.
Yeah, there's no comparison.
I work in a movie theater, obviously, so I've walked in and I've seen a couple scenes, or at least I've seen bits of it, and it didn't seem terrible. So,
no, it seems like a David Gordon. I think David Gordon Green is not a good choice for The Exorcist. Like, say what you about Halloween. Halloween is not The Exorcist. Like,
and I said this before. I actually think his Halloween trilogy is fascinating.
Yeah,
like agreed. I don't think all of it's like 100% successful, but I think the way that he approached the material was way more interesting than maybe some other filmmakers would have approached it.
100%. Because, like, what were we getting before that with Halloween? We got, you know, the Rob Zombie duology, which I have softened on as I've gotten older, but I still don't particularly like either. Halloween Resurrection.
Yeah.
Which is just the worst. Like, by a mile. It's the worst Halloween film.
So, yeah, but, like, at least he breathed some new life into it.
Oh, agreed. I think some directors are great for a movie like Halloween. I don't think, like, as we saw with this, even an Academy Award-winning director like John Borman, he's just not. Some people are just not meant for The Exorcist.
Maybe The Exorcist was lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, exactly. And it's telling, really, that the next film is arguably considered the second best in the series. And it was directed by the writer of the book. Like, it takes a very specific type of person to make an Exorcist film.
And who better than the actual writer?
Well, I mean, yeah, honestly. It's baffling to me because there are actually two novel sequels to The Exorcist.
Oh,
but
okay.
Neither is a direct sequel to The Exorcist. They're both two books that happen to be in the same general continuity.
It's a shared universe. Sort of.
Exactly. So you have the book. Let me double check this, make sure I'm not going crazy here. It's followed by the book Legion. And Legion became The Exorcist 3. Legion is the basis of Exorcist 3. And there's another book, too, that I'm actually drawing a blank on. It's not quite Ninth Configuration. It's something else, but I'll probably come back to you with the actual book name later. I'm just drawing a blank on it right now. But there's another book that focuses on, of all things, the astronaut from the party that Reagan's mom throws at the beginning. When Reagan in the first film, she's like, you know, tells the one guy, you're going to die up there. It follows his story.
Oh.
Yeah. And again, not a direct sequel to The Exorcist. It's just not. But it's just a very compelling little piece of writing that I find very interesting conceptually. But yeah, it's telling that none of these other films really got what made the original film so powerful. This film especially did not get it at all. I don't understand what they were going for with this movie, but I feel like they just misfired in every single level.
I agree with you. It failed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't get upset with sequels like this too often.
No, I'm not even upset. It just was, like, annoying.
Yeah, 100%.
I was like, okay.
It's just like, what is this? Like, what were they thinking?
You just sounded like AVGN.
Oh, gosh. It's happening. I have transitioned into the old boomer on the internet.
What were they thinking?
What were they thinking? And by the way, I love the AVGNs. That's not a bad
mouth. No, I do. I do love AVGN. I still think he's really funny.
Yeah, he's one of the few old school YouTubers who like hasn't done something that's like annoyed me at this point in time.
I think it's because he's stayed away from any controversial thing.
Yeah, he just wants to chill and be a dad. Like I can't fault him for that. Like that's just great in my opinion.
And make his silly videos, which I haven't gone back and watched them. I don't know how much of them are like contain jokes and stuff that are really dated.
Oh, there's a few really dated jokes in the old AVGN stuff.
I'm sure there is.
But like, it's also like you can't like. I mean, I personally don't get upset by them because he was trying to be offensive. So it's like there's a degree of like, okay, I can't be that upset with it.
Well, the newer stuff I've seen, he tends to avoid being that. I think he's chilled out more since he became a dad, is what I'm saying.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
100% there.
Yeah. By the way, fascinating note, when you were talking about Legion,
uh-huh.
Before we start to wrap things up, I decided to Google it. Because I always go to trusty Google.
And
apparently, William Peter Blatty sued the New York Times for claiming that Legion was not included in the New York Times bestseller list.
You know what, though? He probably deserved that, because, quite frankly, Legion's a great book. If you haven't read that also, it's a really good book. Oh my goodness, I'm not surprised.
Let's see. Oh, he lost that case, by the way.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
And he tried to appeal it to the Supreme Court, and they declined to hear it.
Oh my goodness. Oh, Blatty.
The Times won based on the list was not mathematically objective, but was editorial content, and that's protected under the Constitution as free speech.
Oh, so he was right then. So he was right that they screwed him over, but they were like, well, technically he doesn't have to. It's like the Fox News clause, where like technically Fox News doesn't count, and there's not enough news in Fox News to sue it as a news source.
Yeah.
Oh, that just stinks. That's rough for him, man. I'm not going to lie. That's rough. So he's right, but this is not enough of a case for it.
Yeah, this was back in the 80s. He sued in 83.
Poor guy. That stinks. I mean, poor guy. He wrote one of the best-selling novels of all time. We can only wish to be as successful, but still.
Oh my goodness.
You find these like really interesting information about things that you don't expect. You know? Oh,
every time. It's always like something strange you find out about these people. Like, it's... Oh, he actually... Wait a second. Wait, what is... Hang on. So I'm on his Wikipedia page right now, too. Okay, that's a whole... It's a whole other discussion right there. He had wars with, like, Georgetown University. Oh, my goodness. That's wonky. All right, whatever. He's a weird dude.
Yeah, it seemed... That's the vibe I'm getting.
Yeah, he's out there. He was out there. He's now no longer alive. Great novelist, but he was a figure, shall we say. And sometimes director, too.
Yeah, true. And I think with that, that is a perfect segue for us to get into wrapping this week's episode up and preparing us for the next episode, where we will cover The Exorcist 3.
A much better movie.
Yeah, I keep hearing it's much better. So
it's a movie I'm excited to revisit. I'll put it that way. And I am curious if Jazzy's going to like it as much as I do. Because she was not as big a fan of the original, but has come around a bit on it. And I'm curious if she's going to have.
I want to hear her opinion in the next episode too of the second film.
100%.
Because that's going to be a whole other conversation.
Yeah. So, Jazzy, what do you think of The Locusts?
Fuck you. She's going to be like, why'd you make me watch this?
Oh, I can't wait. So, Jazzy, what did you think of that wonderful scene where Reagan cures autism by smiling?
She probably jumped through the computer screen. And strangle us.
She may kill me, but that's a risk I'm willing to take.
That's a risk I'm willing to take. You should find John Borman and see if he can borrow one of the suits of armor from Excalibur.
Oh God, I wish.
You gotta prepare.
Listen, I wish I could have a suit of armor from Excalibur anyway, under normal circumstances.
You're gonna go to work wearing it.
Would. They'd ask a lot of questions, but I wouldn't care.
It can't trying be to any get less to the door barely walking.
Listen, it can't be any less professional than I wore on a normal basis. So, I'm just saying.
Fair. And with that point, do you want to plug where the people can find you?
Yes, you can find me on the Twitters and the TikToks as AGRAMUGLIA. You can find me if you search Anthony Grimulia on Google. You can probably find either one of the many places I've written for, such as Dread Central, Anime Herald, Anime Feminist, CBR, The Mary Sue, Polygon, etc. Or you can find the many Reddit threads and or threads and other websites making fun of my writing and saying that I am a beta cuck. You can also find me somewhere in New Jersey. I won't say where. You can just keep going door to door until you find me. And so there you go. That's my plug.
And I'm Crystal Williams. You can follow me on Twitter at Crystal W Rocks. I'm also on Blue Sky and a bunch of other places under that same name, Crystal Williams, on Medium, and you can read my articles. Other than that, please listen to more episodes of the Galaxy Geekdom podcast. And we love you, everybody. Hopefully you stick with us as we continue going through these movies. And until next time, goodbye, everybody.